This week, the Supreme Court returned to the issue of affirmative action.
This case starts with a young woman by the name of Abigail Fisher here. She was denied admission by the University of Texas. Abigail Fisher turned around and sued, claiming non-whites were admitted with lower grades than hers.
There were people in my class with lower grades who weren't in all the activities I was in who were being accepted into UT, and the only other difference between us was the color of our skin.
A ruling in Abigail Fisher's favor and against the university would endanger affirmative action policies in universities across the country. In arguments this week, at least one justice seemed unconvinced that the practice is of any value anyway. CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
Let me quote from Scalia. There are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a less a slower track school, he said, where they do well.
This is the second time this case has wound its way to the high court's docket, and Abigail Fisher, who was a high school student when her legal odyssey began 7 years ago, has since graduated from Louisiana State University and is working as a financial analyst in Austin, Texas. She doesn't know how the court will finally rule, but she's already learned what everyone who takes a case to the Supreme Court learns. It's hard work being a poster child.
She took her case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won.
Now they're in the national spotlight, taking their opposition to that California law all the way to the Supreme Court.
The two women who took their case for same-sex marriage to the U.S. Supreme Court became the first couple to tie the knot in California after the court's decision.
Yes, they are intrepid, these plaintiffs who, with their grievances, march through the court system to influence the law of the land. And they're often iconic as well. What you may not know is that plaintiffs who take their cases all the way to the Supreme Court very often are taken by the hand. And first, they are identified, recruited, cultivated, and heavily promoted by lawyers or activists such as Edward Bloom, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and director of the Project on Fair Representation, who located Abigail Fisher only after a 3-year search.
The first thing I did was design a website called UT Not Fair. That website was distributed to folks that I thought could then distribute it to other folks who may have kids who had applied to UT and were rejected. That brought in, I'd say, a little over 200 possible candidates. While that was working, I started giving speeches at various college campuses. I started networking with parents. And through those three mechanisms, I finally found Abigail Fisher.
Although, curiously, not through his outreach efforts, but altogether by chance.
Lo and behold, I know this guy. I've once met his daughter. And that's how the University of Texas lawsuit came to be.
And she was perfect, a petite strawberry blonde whose steely determination is leavened with a sweet smile and agreeable manner. Bingo.
Abigail Fisher is the girl next door. Everyone can look at her and listen to her and realize she's just like my own daughter, or I have a cousin like her, or she's like my sister.
If this were a personal injury case and not a public interest law case, such plaintiff shopping would be barratry, also known as ambulance chasing, which is deemed unethical by every state's bar. But Fisher v. the University of Texas is not about money, and thus the lawyers are given wide berth to find just the right set of facts to match the contentious legal issue, and just the right poster child. In the landmark 2008 Supreme Court case, District of Columbia v. Heller, which confirmed the individual right to own firearms, Cato Institute Chairman and Heller co-counsel Robert Levy recruited six plaintiffs to cover all the bases.
They had to be diverse by gender, by race, by income, by age. They had to have a real need. So it wasn't enough for them to be true believers. They also had to live in a area where they're threatened with violence and had a legitimate basis for wanting the right to defend themselves with a gun. They had to be law-abiding, so we didn't want crackheads as the poster boy for the Second Amendment.
Not that the justices, in all their supremacy, would necessarily be turned off by unsavory plaintiffs. But the court of public opinion is a different matter.
You have to have good stories to tell. And good stories means you have to have good storytellers. So we would look for plaintiffs that were able to express their position clearly and powerfully and were diverse, because the media loves diversity.
The media are also attracted by injustice, drama, and a really solid man-bites-dog yarn. So if you were, say, trawling for sympathetic plaintiffs for a California gay marriage case, how about a couple that was married by the city of San Francisco, then unmarried by the state Supreme Court, then barred from getting married again by state constitutional referendum Proposition 8? That would be Sandy Steer and Chris Perry, riding the Six Flags bizarro of legal roller coasters. When the referendum results came in 2008, they were shattered. You and your wife said, "This will not stand," marched to a lawyer, and began a legal odyssey that took you all the way to the Supreme Court, right?
No, that is not how it happened.
Chris Perry.
We went in a bunker. We went back to our lives, continued to raise our children, go to work every day, contribute to the community we lived in, and in some ways didn't hold our heads as high as we had previously. We couldn't think of any solution other than just to tolerate it.
And then the lawyers found them, not by beating the bushes for the photogenic aggrieved, but by 6 degrees of Hollywood separation. Perry, who is an early childhood education advocate, happened through movie director Rob Reiner to encounter another pre-K education advocate, Chad Griffin, who was also an LGBT activist of long standing and was about to mount a national legal challenge on marriage rights. So, long story short, Hollingsworth v. Perry, which in 2013 legalized gay marriage in California once and for all and helped pave the way for marriage equality nationwide. The roller coaster has glided to safety.
It is really rewarding to sit here today, but we were semi-panicked the entire time over not prevailing and being the poster children of a failed effort. It was also scary at times. We were harassed. They were scared for our safety. We kept the blinds shut. You wake up, you open the front door, and is that the day they come?
The constitutional poster child role is not easy, and it is not new. Susan Carl, civil rights historian and professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law, says plaintiff shopping is as old as the fight for equal justice under the law. The Plessy of the notorious Plessy-Ferguson decision was a so-called octoroon, selected to sit in a first-class train car explicitly so he would be refused service to test laws permitting segregation.
The earliest mention I can find of the strategy is a Baltimore organization called the Brotherhood of Liberty. And they were trying to use test case litigation to challenge transportation segregation, discrimination in bar admissions on the basis of race. Brotherhood of Liberty was operating in the 1830s or so, so it goes back a long way.
Carl says that Brown v. Board of Education, which overturned Plessy Ferguson and ended legal segregation, consolidated local cases that
were very carefully chosen so that they represented jurisdictions all around the country, South Carolina, Washington, D.C., Delaware, Prince Edwards County in Virginia, and Kansas, to make it very clear that this was a national problem and needed a national solution.
Things don't always go as planned. Bob Levy, in litigating District of Columbia v. Heller, located 6 highly sympathetic plaintiffs. The National Rifle Association, which was mounting a parallel challenge, came in with 5 more. All 11 had wonderful demeanors and harrowing, even heroic, stories to tell. And 10 of 11 were kicked out of the litigation because they did not meet the D.C. Circuit's threshold of standing.
Kafkaesque. That was a shame, particularly Parker, who was the lead plaintiff and was really the one with the most compelling story. She had her life threatened by drug dealers, you know, lived in a really bad neighborhood, and she was most eloquent about her need for a gun and her dedication to gun rights, but she no longer was part of the lawsuit, so we felt bad for her.
But one plaintiff, a security guard named Dick Heller, stuck, and he prevailed. His name is now part of history, as perhaps will be Abigail Fisher's, whose case was first remanded by the court, but now will be heard this term after her 7-year odyssey. Advocate Edward Bloom.
The first and most important virtue is that of courage, because these lawsuits will last a long time. Your personal life will be analyzed and vilified on social media.
Edward, you know how Groucho Marx said he wouldn't belong to a club that would have him as a member?
Of course.
Do you really want a plaintiff who would be crazy enough to proceed on a matter like this?
I absolutely do need a plaintiff crazy enough and committed enough to take on a high-profile issue like this. Let's face it. If Fisher versus the University of Texas is successful, then Abby's name will go down in history as the young woman that challenged UT. That could one day be harmful to her in her life's endeavors. So thank goodness that there are people like Abigail Fisher who are willing to take the heat for the rest of their lives for their participation in this.
Not to mention Bloom's own crusade. After almost 3 years of plaintiff shopping, when Fisher finally agreed to commit to the case, come what may, was it all champagne corks and high fives for her sponsor and advocate?
I think I choke up a lot more than I high five in life. It was a moment of kind of reflection, and your throat swells up a little bit. Much more of an emotional moment for me than it was a celebratory moment.
But maybe, if he has chosen well, in a few months he and his fellow affirmative action opponents will have something historic to celebrate.
Bob's piece originally aired as part of a full hour we did about the Supreme Court. Go to onthemedia.org to listen to that and also to subscribe to our newsletter. This has been an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Brooke Gladstone.